The story of Tomah, Genesis 38, is about rights, responsibility, oppression, and God. The context is patriarchy, maybe as early as 10th century BCE. Men rule, women serve, and are breeders. If you don't serve and you don't breed, your worth is minimal. So on one level, the story is not about Tomah at all, but about the patriarch Judah. Judah had three sons, the eldest of whom, married Tomah. The text is brief and pointed. He was wicked and God slew him. Wickedness is not explained. What is explained is that was childless, and as per Deuteronomy 25, 5 and following, it was the duty of Ur's siblings to go in to Tomah, so that she conceive and thus perpetuate the dead brother's name. In Israel at this time, there was no belief in afterlife bodily resurrection. Your offspring were your afterlife. But this custom was not just for the benefit of the deceased. It protected the woman from economic deprivation and a sort of social wilderness. The childless widow was no longer a virgin in her father's family and no longer belonged there. Rather, she remained a barren wife in her dead husband's family until the so-called curse of barrenness was lifted. The second son of Judah, Onan, however, practices a primitive form of birth control. The sin of Onan, though, is not birth control, but refusing to meet his obligations and to help create another man's children. His reason was probably greed. Onan might have preferred to divide his inheritance with the one remaining brother, dividing it two ways. Rather than also with the family of his deceased brother, dividing it three ways. Again, God pops up to kill another brother. The next step following Deuteronomy should have been that the third son of Judah, Shelah, goes in to Tomah. But Judah hesitates. He doesn't want his last son to die too. Tomah seems jinxed. Perhaps he feared she was a witch of sorts who killed her lovers. Fear and suspicion distract Judah from his responsibilities and the rights of Tomah. Judah tells her to return to her father's house. There she is not a virgin, a wife, nor a mother. There she is either to be pitied or to be scorned. No one petitions Judah on her behalf. No one cries out for justice. No one seems to befriend Tomah, affirm her personhood, or tell her she has done nothing wrong. She is terribly alone, and hope seems lost. Between verses 11 and 12, something happened for Tomah. What it was, we have no idea. But she moved from despair, from thoughts of suicide, maybe, from feeling wronged and victimized, to determining that she would take hold of her own future. Despite her social powerlessness as a woman and a barren widow at that, she determined to confront the injustice. And she changed history. There is in mythology a character called a trickster. This is someone, real or imagined, who breaks the rules. A trickster confronts the powers and often triumphs through trickery. The role of the trickster is to point to the deep truth that the sacred often comes through upset, reversal, and surprise. Tomah the trickster disguises herself as a prostitute and waits on the edge of town. Along comes Judah and avails himself of her services. As surety in lieu of payment, Tomah keeps Judah's ring and staff. Tomah conceives from her encounter with Judah, and the proverbial hits the fan. She has invited scandal, and scandal has come. In response to the anger and death threats that Tomah's supposed adultery elicits, she produces the ring and staff. Judah perceives the truth. She is more right than I, he admits, since I did not give to her my third-born son. Judah acknowledges he is wrong. Note in verse 26 where it says, he, Judah, did not lie with her again. Scholars wonder whether this is just an admonition against incest, or whether it reflects Judah's fear of a woman who has survived two husbands and has boldly bettered him. He is wary of the once was powerless one. Tamar, like Rebecca before her, gives birth to twin boys, the mark of a special matriarch. The text vindicates her ethically scandalous action. While this is a story of a woman's courage, it is to its patriarchal audience about Judah. Judah has no love for his father, Jacob, who neglected him. Judah then loses two sons, and he does not protect the widow rights of Tamar. Jacob has lost a son too, Joseph, thanks to the jealous brothers. This story of Tamar is a lesson for Judah, a lesson in feeling empathy for his father, and a lesson in trying not to protect what he loves, his son Shelah, by denying what is right, justice for Tamar. These lessons are at the heart of reconciliation. It is Judah who in later chapters facilitates the reconciliation with Joseph and the brothers, and thus saves the fledgling Hebrew nation. Not surprisingly, then, the genealogical line of blessing bypasses the firstborn Reuben, bypasses the gifted and big-headed Joseph, and instead goes through Judah, and as Jesus' biographers noted, Tamar. The role of God in this story is interesting. By name, God is simply inserted as a killing machine. God killed God killed Onan. I suspect the author is using God to explain the inexplicable, namely, why two brothers should prematurely die. And I suppose this is preferable to Judah's musings about Tamar being a witch. Note that patriarchal cultures and their religions, like Christianity, have a long history of sticking the label witch on any woman who seems different or outside their control. Using God as a literary tool to explain the inexplicable is vacuous. We can, of course, psychologically understand it. We can, for example, empathize with a young man this week that attributed his survival to God while his school friends died in the raging floodwaters. Surviving while others perish can be deeply disturbing. Yet theologically, it is nonsense. God doesn't rescue one teenager and kill the others. Similarly, while the patriarchal authors might only be able to see God in death, the God of the prophets and powerless is present in the whole of the narrative, even if not explicitly named. There is a saying in our gospel today about the deity being in Jesus and Jesus being in the deity. I would claim that in her powerlessness, in her willingness to risk scandal, and in her trickery of the patriarch, the deity was in Tamar, and Tamar was in the deity. God is present in the story, and that presence is seen most powerfully in Tamar. As we read afresh this story, let us hear three challenges. Firstly, to make time and effort to tell those who are marginal and despairing that we believe in them, that we are glad they exist, that we are glad that they are beautiful human beings worthy of respect and dignity. And in addition to being empathetic, let us take some responsibility, like Judah should have. Secondly, let us be alert for the deep truth that God often is known and comes alive among us through upset, reversal, and surprise. The institutional church has great problems with this. It wants to control and prescribe God. It doesn't see God in barren widows, tricky prostitutes, or strong-minded women. Let us be alert to God in places and people where we don't believe God could be. Lastly, and similarly, let us be mindful that the one who initiates a scandal, who seems to have sinned in the eyes of the church and world, could well be the bearer of the truth that sets us free. Can God be in the guise of a prostitute? Yes.